The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. It is 4 minutes past nine on this Monday, the 16th of January, 2023. You're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show, another week of the programme. It's a busy one. You know it's going to be busy anyway. I say it because I can say it with confidence. We've got so much lined up for you to keep you informed and entertained. We want to know what you want to talk about as well, any stories you want to pass on. Maybe there's all positive stuff as well, you know. That's more than welcome here. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts that number, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. If you wish, you can email comments@highlandradio.com. you can message me on my social media, or you can watch on our social media. Go to YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. We're streaming for you there, as we are across our Facebook pages and on our website, highlandradio.com. That's highlandradio.com. Right, as I say, plenty to keep you informed, entertained as this Monday cracks on. It was a cold one overnight, wasn't it? It's going to be cold all week. Mild weather returning on Friday. But did you see the snow in some parts of the county yesterday? Dozens of vehicles caught out at Meanaroy there. I don't think we've seen anything as bad since, but it just goes to show in a county that's geographically made up as ours is, in one part of the county, lovely weather. In another, people are trapped in snow. It's crazy, really, when you think about it. Let's see what's happening in the papers today. The Derry People, Donegal News. A HSE worker has said the removal or downgrading of Naudoc in Letterkenny would be a devastating blow to the county. And of course, it's not just Letterkenny either, by the way. Possible changes to the operations of the out-of-hour service in the northwest could see CareDoc, which supplies GPs for the Naudoc service, taking over the region. Under proposals, the Naudoc call centre and triage will no longer be based in Letterkenny, but instead operate out of Carlow. This has sparked concerns that the delivery of care for patients locally would be negatively impacted. The employee, who did not wish to be named, was speaking as fears continued to mount that the future of out-of-hour services following the commencement of a review into how services in the region are currently being carried out. The employee said staff were left devastated after being told of the possible takeover. They said the service is invaluable as an out-of-hours medical backup for the Donegal public. In addition, it helps keep numbers down in accident and emergency. The staff were told of a possible takeover and are awaiting HSE letters. But this is, I got sight of the initial letter from CareDoc a number of weeks ago now, and it wasn't clear whether or not sort of a drop-in in Letterkenny would be gone or not. But as I say, it's just important to point out that it's not just Letterkenny here. There's swathes of the county with their own Naudoc offices that are also concerned. The Derry News this morning: ratepayers in the Derry City and Strabane District Council area are facing the prospect of a 12% increase in the rate bills in the incoming financial year. The rate will be struck in the first week of February. A special meeting to discuss the situation took place on Friday. It was attended by council staff, councillors, MPs Gregory Campbell and Colm Eastwood, and MLAs Gary Middleton, Ciara Ferguson, Padraig DeLargy, Mark H. Durkin and Sinead McLaughlin. Derry News understands council is also considering a wide range of cuts to its services in an effort to reduce its annual expenditure. On to the Irish Times now. What do you make of this Pascal Donoghue story? He, at the time, was head of the department which heads up SIPO, and now he finds himself reported to SIPO. And it seemed in his statement and subsequent questions that he feels maybe that, you know, he always holds himself up to the high standards. And almost, how dare you question that I should do anything purposely? But you know what? We're all the same here, and everyone deserves the same level of scrutiny. Really bucketing down with snow here at the mountaintop at the moment. I don't know what it's like where you are. But anyway, Minister for Public Expenditure Pascal Donoghue failed to properly record election expenses paid by a friend who was later included on a list of names he submitted as suitable to head up a state task force headquartered in his constituency. Now, this is either a remarkable coincidence or certainly requires, well, in any case, it requires some explanation. Mr. Donoghue last night apologised at length for submitting the inaccurate returns, which he believed were accurate and true at the time he put them in. But ignorance is not a defence either. He said he now accepted he failed to correctly record €1,057 in election expenses, which was paid for in the form of a donation to Dublin Central Fine Gael by the businessman Michael Stone. Mr. Donoghue said he had in recent weeks become aware €917 had been paid to six workers for postering by Mr. Stone before the election. He had previously believed the work was done on a voluntary basis, that these seven people were just working out of the pure love of the man. The use of a van owned by Mr. Stone's company for the postering was valued at €140. Mr. Donoghue became aware of this in 2017 and on last evening said he would have amended his election expenses then, saying it was a clear oversight on my part, which I acknowledge and apologise for. Right, okay, I think there's a much more to that story. I think a politician that holds that, whose department holds all other politicians to account, should also be held to the highest level of account there. All right, interesting interview on that I heard on national radio in the morning, in that the journalist in question was questioning a Sinn Féin representative and was actually arguing on behalf of Mr. Donoghue. What if he forgot about this, and what about this, and would, you know, do all parties not do that? I thought it was a peculiar position for a journalist to take. Mr. Donoghue, I'm sure, would be well capable of going on the radio and defending himself. But it was interesting to hear a journalist nationally putting arguments as to why this is okay to a member of the opposition. I don't think that's objective journalism, really. I think that's the role of Mr. Donoghue to come on and do that himself. The Irish Independent, just 15 nursing home groups own 40% of all private nursing home beds in this country, an unpublished government report reveals. The first major audit of the sector shows that global nursing home groups and international investment firms, along with a large scale Irish operator, owns 10,720 of all private beds in Ireland. The report finds there has been significant consolidation in private nursing care in recent years. Operators with multiple homes now make up the majority of the market. The data reveals the number of big operators with more than 100 beds increased dramatically between 2016 and 2021 the years under review, while the number of smaller homes with fewer than 20 beds has fallen. Now, I don't know what the consequence of that is, to be completely honest with you, in terms of nursing bed ownership and who owns them and the negatives or pros in that regard. Interestingly, they just manage one paragraph on Pascal Donoghue on the front of the Irish Independent there. Nothing of that story on the front of the rest of the papers I'll be looking at, as far as I could see. The Irish Daily Mail tells us that tensions are growing in the coalition over controversial proposed tax breaks for developers being used to fix the housing crisis. Sounds all very familiar, this, doesn't it? Taoiseach Leo Varadkar favours tax breaks, and other Fine Gael cabinet ministers advocate absolving builders of VAT on materials. Justice Minister Simon Harris says he's in favour of providing help to builders to confront viability of building due to rising costs of materials. However, Fianna Fáil ministers and the Department of Finance, led by Fianna Fáil Minister Michael McGrath, are opposed to tax breaks, VAT holidays or any such measures, it's been learned. Fianna Fáil ministers, due to historic accusations of close relationships with the building sector, do not want to support such tax policies. But Leo Varadkar, of course, is the Taoiseach, so it's really up to him, isn't it? On to the other tabloids here now. The Irish Daily Star, telling you something you probably already know. One in three Irish people are struggling to make ends meet during the ongoing cost of living crisis, new research has found. It comes as pressure grows on government to extend several temporary cost of living measures put in place last year that are due to expire at the end of February. This includes reductions in the excise duty on petrol and VAT that have been in place since last March. We kind of forgot about those, didn't we? A new red CWIN, WIN, International Survey, published today, has found that 30% of the Irish population say that they are struggling to make ends meet, one in three of us. This increases amongst people aged 35 and 54 years, with 37% of this cohort struggling. Some 37% of people from lower economic backgrounds also find it difficult to make ends meet, the survey found. Just a quarter of people described their financial situation as comfortable, the minority. The annual Win World Survey on the cost of living crisis garnered the views of 30,000 individuals in 36 countries. Are you feeling the squeeze now? In what area in particular are you finding it more difficult? 086 60 25,000 or call 07491 25,000. We have Donna Marie and Emma taking your calls this morning. Right, on to now the Sun newspaper and some. I mean, it was an awful tragic situation with the plane crash in Nepal. An Irishman was on board that plane. An Irishman was among the passengers on board a plane that crashed in Nepal, resulting in at least 69 people losing their lives. Footage of the Asian country's worst crash in almost three decades shows the jet flip on its side near Pokhara International Airport before crashing into the ground. And I suppose in this day and age as well, everything is being recorded between people on the plane recording. Also, you had situations whereby, of course, there were people on the ground. You know, you've got video cams on doorbells and all that kind of stuff. Nothing goes unseen anymore. And some shocking imagery of people in their last moments there. It was really, really sad. 72 people were on board the flight at the time, including three children. The Department of Foreign Affairs said it is aware of reports that an Irishman was among the people on the plane. However, there has been no update on whether he is among the people who lost their lives. But everyone who was on that plane at this point now is expected to have lost their lives. And apparently the pilot went to great efforts, because that is an airport that's in a relatively populated area, went to great efforts to land the plane as much as he or she could. I'm not sure of their gender. In a piece of land that wasn't populated. And finally, it's a small piece here, but we might dig into the statistics a little bit more. 1% of the Ireland's population owns 1% of Irish population have amassed 21 trillion of new wealth in the past 2 years. That's the world, sorry. Oxfam found extreme wealth and extreme poverty have increased simultaneously for the first time in 25 years. There are Irish statistics, which I'll get to. I'll find them for you. It's like, I don't really understand, you know, different social systems or tax systems or what have you, but there's a very small amount of people that have more money than a large swathe of people with less money. Now, I'm not saying you go and take their money and you give it to other people, because people have worked very hard to earn that money. But you certainly tax them at least equivalent to what you tax poor people and distribute the wealth that way in terms of spending on education, health, you know, the Gardaí, all the usual stuff. But I'll get the statistics as it relates to as it relates specifically to Ireland. It's in one of the newspapers, The Times. I thought I had it there, but I didn't. So leave that with me. But it's just shocking that so few people are so, so wealthy in this country whilst others struggle. All right, it is time for us to take a break. We will be right back. Okay, we welcome on to the programme now retired vet Gerard Rorty. Good morning, Gerard.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us. How are you keeping?
Very well, thank you. We're feeding cattle here in the wintry morning.
I was going to say, do you ever really retire as a vet?
You don't.
No,
because you're still obviously going to look after your own animals indeed.
And so the phone goes now and again too. Right, Gerard, you're concerned about a shortage of vets in Ireland, in Donegal, or where?
Well, we're concerned about a shortage of practicing cattle vets, or people who are interested in working as cattle vets on the island of Ireland generally, but Donegal invariably is the canary in the war in the mine, because it's 600 points to get into most vet schools, and that's an awful challenge. And we don't have access to the grind schools and the Institute of Education and so on that other kids have closer to Dublin. So we've noticed the problem get progressively worse over the last 20 years. The graduates from Dublin don't particularly want to work in cattle practice. But in addition to that, Dublin can't simply produce enough vets. So I've been part of a lobby group that has been lobbying the government for the last 10 years, saying we need a new vet school in the island of Ireland. So that's a real good news story, but from a procurement point of view, it's the National Children's Hospital all over again.
It's not going well then, I take it?
It's going fantastic insofar as we have a commitment from the Minister for Higher Education, a commitment from the government to go ahead and do that school. And we're absolutely overjoyed with that. What's not going well is the procurement and the design. And as I mentioned, the Children's Hospital, this has been done on the hoof. And we are saying, particularly for Donegal, there's very specific criteria that we need. Government, as particularly Higher Education Authority, has missed that criteria. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to register so that our vets can go in and practice in Northern Ireland and vice versa. And this is a Brexit problem. And I can see what has happened to them. A lot of this work was started 10 years ago before Brexit. And Brexit has caught them short-sighted. And we're saying you've got to realise and recognise now that this is a school that has to be designed with the challenges of Brexit in mind.
All right, so for those of us not in the know, talk to me where the problems are then. Do we have a location for it?
In terms of location, there are three bids for the tender. ATU, which I think is a fantastic bid. Now, I should emphasise, I have no hand, act, nor part of the ATU bid, but LYAT will be part of it, and that's a really exciting bid, and I wish them well. There are three bids. The veterinary group, the group of practitioners I'm involved with, we're neutral in terms of the successful bid. What we're saying is, let's design the procurement procedure properly so that the best horse will jump the fence, it will go to the best location. But what we have reservations about is how the procurement design has been done, with particular reservations that any corrections are proposed to be done on the hoof. And that's what ran us into the £1 billion problem in the Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. So I had an opportunity to be on a Zoom call with some of the other vets involved in this, with some of the special advisors for the government and the HEA last Monday. And we pointed out, we said, look, there's a particular problem here. Post-Brexit, our vets aren't automatically going on to the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons Registrar. So from Donegal the whole way around to Louth, it's a real must that the vets employed there are going to be able to slip across the border and do calls and Castledare, go into Strabane or Derry or you know, similarly the whole way around the border. If you're sitting in Louth, you can nip into Forkhill or whatever. And it was something I don't think they actually realised, because the British government has taken quite a hard line in terms of mutual recognition qualifications. My other profession, for example, in dentistry, they have ceased to recognise a lot of the dental qualifications that were registrable coming in from Europe. And those dentists now are waiting on an exam that's going to be set every 2 years. So we started to ask questions then. We were kind of a little bit surprised they hadn't thought that. So we said, like, who's on this panel that's designed it? And they said, there's 19 people. We said, that's fantastic. And then we said, like, how many vets of those 19? And we were told there was one. And there was a long pause. And then I asked the hard question. I said, how many of those 19 vets have practiced in the last 30 years in private practice? Well, there's none. It's a very, very eminent civil servant. So it started, just took a step back and said, well, hold on. The normal criteria when you're designing a new faculty of veterinary medicine is you do what was done in England in Nottingham, or you do what was done in Harper Adams or in Keele, and you gather together an international panel of experts. So you're aiming to be as good, for the sake of argument, as a UCD vet school.
Yeah.
So you say, we want to get to make sure we have accreditation to the Royal College so the kids can go practice in the north. But in addition, we want a world-class institute. So let's design it and let's build it with the objective that we'll get accreditation from Australasia and America and Europe. And the way you do that is you invite somebody, an international panel of experts on those boards. So I put that point to the special advisor. She got it. She agreed with it. And she said, well, yeah, but she says, we don't have time. And my response back was, look, we've waited 123 years since we built the last set school in Balls Ridge in 1900. I hear what you're saying. It's going to delay the project a month. But what's going to happen is midway through the project, whoever gets it is going to go back to the government and say, look, this is a must. We need to take it to the standard. We've got to redesign the course, redesign the campus, redesign the buildings. And at that stage, as I mentioned, Children's Hospital, the grant is, the contracts have already been awarded. So you're going to go back to step one. So we just don't get it in terms of what is happening in procurement. We just can't understand how you can have 19 people We have more dentists and doctors on the evaluation panel for a new vet school than we have vets.
Well, let me ask you this. Were you able to ascertain how that panel is established? You know what I mean? If you're dealing specifically with the establishment of a vet training facility, did you inquire as to how this panel was assessed for its suitability for this type of project?
We did. I asked that very specific question, and the response was that the same panel, they have a panel of really esteemed people of a medical background looking at the expansion of medical places and dental places. And from what I can see, the added-on ones
of
the that panel.
Right, okay.
Yeah, which is, and listen, I am in no way casting aspersions. I mean, the academic qualifications and the pedigree of those 19 people are second to none. Mm-hmm. But they are not people who know an awful lot about designing new vet schools. They're not people that know an awful lot about veterinary academia. I mean, the first question, the really obvious question, I didn't answer it. Ask it, for example, was that probably one of the most esteemed people in veterinary education worldwide is Professor Michael Doherty, practicing in Anishinaabe. He's a dairyman. He's dean of the UCD Vet School. You know, and I was just expecting him straight away to come back and say someone like Professor Michael Doherty is heading up the panel. And then when we realised, God, we have nobody from Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, we just thought, well, hold on. You know, we talk an awful lot about Shared Island. We talk an awful lot about trying to ensure that we have a greater movement of kids between the various third level institutions. And I'm delighted to say that McGee Graduate Medical School is reserving 20% of their places for students from the south. And veterinary is unusual because we're one epidemiological unit, irrespective of political divisions. Disease moves, as we know, in foot and mouth throughout the 32 counties. So it's always been very important to be conscious of that in terms of delivering veterinary services. And the history and nature of the vet school has always been that way. I mean, the vet school I went to was the same vet school set up in 1900. And that vet school always educated kids from 32 counties. And to this day, reserves places. And now you're going to be saying to kids from Northern Ireland, well, come down and go to a vet school. But, yeah, we don't think you'll get accreditation.
Okay, well,
or you may not be able to get accreditation.
Yeah, you very clearly, I think, outlined that very few people would struggle to argue against the very strong argument made as it relates to the procurement of this. When you've raised these issues with them, when you highlighted the fact that, you know, there is a clear gap there in people with knowledge in this specific area, and you've made the strong arguments, the cross-border element of it and all the rest, is it being reviewed, or were you told, well, this is just the way it is?
We were told, unfortunately, this is the way it is. So today, throughout the 32 counties of Ireland, you're going to have a practicing vet or someone like me, a retired vet, going on to every radio show, because as practitioners, we're based throughout the 32 counties. And we're going on to local media and to local radio stations to say, look, it's fantastic that we're finally getting a vet school. Because the other big part of the argument that we've been making, Greg, and I'm delighted to hear that they're listening to us, is this idea that we're taking in kids with 600 points and all A1s to vet schools is not working. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just making the point that it's very clear that those sort of kids do not stay in practice. You don't need 600 points to go in Cavacow and Gortahur, Glenamaddy, Glenfin, Glenswilly.
I mean, that bar is so high. They really, really, really want to be a vet because there's
It's quite the opposite, Greg. What tends to happen is that the kids who get that are kids who either go to green schools in Bruce College in Limerick or the Institute, or, you know, we have fantastic schools in Donegal, but an awful lot of them are not just geared up. They're geared to educate everybody. They're not geared up like the green schools are geared up to deliver the 600 points. So we end up getting a geographical bias, particularly towards South County Dublin, of people who get very, very high points. And we do not get, and this is something I've talked to Tim Cullinan about at length, Irish Farmers Association president. In fact, I talked to Tim again on Thursday about this procurement problem. We are not getting the students into the vet school in UCD at the moment who particularly want to practice as cattle vets.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting the kids who want to do ponies and puppies, and that's fantastic, that's brilliant, that's needed too. But there's a real shortage of kids that want to actually go and work as cattle vets. So the new school, one of the criteria for the new school, or one of the objectives, is that they will be biased towards taking in children that will probably all get Bs in their leaving cert, or the equivalent of the roughly 500 points, but will have shown a particular background or interest. They may have gone to, in agriculture. They may
but
have,
once,
may have gone
once
to an agriculture
all of these students have qualified, does that mean there's then a hierarchy within veterinary practice? In other words, a certain level of whereby you have some that would do the cattle calving, etc., and then the others that have a nice posh place in Dublin 4 and look after puppies and stuff.
No,
will there be a hierarchy?
Far from it, because when we ran Donegal Animal Hospital, our vets were all geared and equipped to treat horses and to treat cats and dogs and to treat absolutely every animal. So in the same way within the medical profession, a doctor is a doctor and is trained and equipped in various areas. But what the real challenge at the moment is that, yeah, the vet school can train people that are equipped and competent and have the ability to work with farm animals and to work with small animals. The difficulty that we've had is in the vet school in UCD for the last 20 years, the predominant interest has been in kids who want to practice in small animals. Now, they come out fantastically competent and very well trained, capable of doing cattle work, but they have no interest.
Yeah, but I just don't see the connection. And how do you incentivize or how do you
You change your entrance criteria, we have an agreement from Higher Education Authority. You change your entrance criteria.
Yeah, but I don't understand. I don't understand that. Even if you say, I don't understand, Jared. Say, for instance, you happen to get 100 less points, and you are enrolled in this course. What then would make you more inclined to work in the area of veterinary practice that we're talking of here, working with farm animals, for example, rather than once you're qualified, saying actually,
I probably didn't explain the change in entrance criteria adequately. Not only are you going to go in with 100 less points, but you're also going to have displayed some sort of a background that indicates that you have an interest in agriculture.
But it doesn't guarantee anything. You just hope that that leads to more people.
It doesn't, but it's been shown in Nottingham Vet School, for example, to work. I'll give you the case in point. Harper Adamants and Nottingham Vet, various vet schools in England have gone on this road. What they have done is they have taken the top five graduate out of various agricultural colleges. So it's not even as if somebody can say, right, this now is a loophole to get into vet school. Mm-hmm. I'll go off to Ballyhays or Gortine or whatever, do an agricultural course. You're going to do the top five. And what you're going to do is you're going to take people who have displayed from day get-go a bias or an interest towards agriculture. Mm-hmm. Now, what the elephant in the room and what we can't discuss is that in every other jurisdiction you can have an interview. We can't have an interview because just we have such a tradition and a history of nepotism. Mm-hmm. But going back to my earlier point, if from get-go at the start we don't have the criteria set up, if we don't have the procurement set up properly, it doesn't matter where the vet school goes, it doesn't matter where the aspirations are, we wind up with a vet school that, from an accreditation point of view and a standard point of view, will need a serious amount of money spent mid-design.
Yeah, I get you.
And as I mentioned, the Children's Hospital, you go and you have to change your contract.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Jared, if all goes well, right, okay, when do you start seeing an increase in output here in terms of new vets that would be available to address the clear shortages we have, say, for instance, here in Donegal? Like, do you think it's a situation where the problems might get worse before they get better? Are we likely to see further retirements or people moving into different areas of veterinary practice before we start seeing a conveyor belt of people coming through? Like, what do you optimistically see as a timeline?
We're hoping this school will open 24. The first grads will come out 29. So you're looking at 5 to 6 years down the line. And as I said, our proposal to put together, we have looked that it will take the Higher Education Authority roughly 3 weeks to put together a panel who should assess the bids and redesign the criteria. So we can see that's not going to have any impact on the delay one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just saying, like, it's a spend of 100 million. And in terms of the history of the state, this is the most expensive investment the state has ever gone into, because it's incredibly expensive to educate vets.
And yet it's somewhat under the radar, isn't it, if the truth be told, until
very
this
much,
morning.
Yeah. It is, but it's not with farmers, because, listen, us farmers are very, very aware.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that we are seeing, what we have seen is lack of vets coming into practice who have an interest in cattle work or an interest in farm animals. Mm-hmm. And we're also very aware of is how short a period of time those people stay. I mean, the classic example is in Donegal. You've only to talk to any farmer in Donegal and they'll tell you vet comes, vet goes, because they realise after a very short period of time they're not particularly interested in working with cattle or working with sheep. And again, unless I've got a geographical bias in terms of I want to see more kids from Donegal getting into the vet schools. I mean, if you were to count, I could just count in my hands, in one hand, how many people in the last 20 years have gone into the UCD vet school. And then with the ridiculous situation of people having to spend probably 40, 50 grand to head off to Eastern Europe to get into vet school. So I didn't mention that. I mean, at the moment, part of the, not the solution, yeah, but part of the way that people can get into vet school is head off to Krakow or Budapest or Warsaw or wherever. And that is fine. But, you know, it's ridiculous the amount of money is involved in heading off there.
And clearly not for everyone. Right, OK. Well, and just very finally, does this process fall under the control of Charlie McConlow's department because there's an agricultural
Listen, if it fell under the problem of Charlie McConlow's department, it would have been sorted because Charlie has such an incredible grasp of agriculture and farming matters. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't. It falls under a Wicklow man, Simon Harris. I mean,
of course,
like,
yes,
for another day's discussion, what we should have is, you know, and I'm wearing a farming hat, Charlie McConlow delivered probably the best scheme, the organic agriculture scheme for Donegal that has boosted Donegal farmers by any Minister for Agriculture.
But is there an argument then for sort of something like this for the likes of the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Higher Education to work in tandem? But we don't really think like that in this country in any case.
Not only do we not think like that, but unfortunately, as you know, government departments in particular, not the ministers, but the departments of civil servants are very territorial.
Of course.
We have very clearly been told this is higher education. Simon Harris, he makes the decisions.
All right, yo. Listen, Jared, thanks for the insight. I'll let you get back
brilliant,
at it.
Brilliant, Greg.
We appreciate
brilliant.
Your time. All right,
thanks
take care.
Thanks again.
Right, 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text line if you want in on that conversation.
Cutting through the spin. The 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
All right, okay. We are joined now on the programme by two gentlemen from AA Ireland, Blake Boland and Paddy Common. Blake, I'll say good morning to you first. How are you keeping?
Hello. Hey, guys.
Is that the two? He's on the one call. Okay, very good. Nice to have you on
yes,
with us.
No, we just got Jay Blake just arrived, so I'm Paddy, that's Blake.
Okay, good to have you with us. Right, okay, so you have... Is this the first time anyone has driven from Mizzenhead to Malinhead in an EV on a single charge?
We believe so, yeah. We have asked whether anyone else has done it. We've asked some of the various EV groups. We haven't heard back yet, but we don't think so because basically there hasn't been the car that would do it. We are sitting in this car now. It's the Mercedes-Benz EQS. It is very, very expensive, mind you, but it is... showing that the technology is there to do it. So we set out last Wednesday and we drove down to Mizzenhead. Now, we did that direction because it was a pretty stormy day, so we wanted the wind behind us. And we drove the close to 600 kilometres in about 9 hours or so, pretty much crawling over the line in Malinhead, but you know, we did manage it, and it is an indication that technology is moving on. However, there is a bit of an issue with charging points, because once we got to Malin, we were pretty much stuck. We had to put a 3-pin plug out the door of the Malinhead View B&B to try and get us a little bit of charge.
So you got all the way from Cork to Donegal, the tip of Donegal, and then you had to get the granny charger out.
Yeah, we got the granny cable out the door of the B&B. And,
I don't know why it's called that, by the way. I hope it's not offensive to grannies. I don't believe it is. But anyway, it's a 3-pin plug.
Yeah, it's a slightly offensive phrase that people use for the 3-pin plug. But look, it was great to do it, but it's great to see the technology coming on. But it was really an indication of, certainly for Donegal in particular, charging points are really, really hard to find, you know, and it is a bit of an issue as the technology moves on. And as sales increase, we're now 81% more than we were last year. So there really needs to be improvement, especially for you guys up in Donegal.
Yeah, Blake, what is the advertised range of the Mercedes?
Yeah, it's up past 700 kilometres in the WLTP range figure. However, they can be a little bit optimistic sometimes. They're always better off shaving a little bit off that. So we reckon that this Mercedes is a 600 kilometre kind of real world range car.
Right. Did you have the aircon on the way all the way up?
We did a little bit, yeah. It's a very, very high-tech car that we're in for the price you'd expect it as well. But it has a mode called Eco Plus. So the car is a heat pump as opposed to the usual heaters that we'd have in our car. So a lot more efficient. But what it does is it scavenges heat from the motor, the electronics and the battery of the car, puts that into the cabin and kept us at a temperature. I was happy enough in my hoodie the whole time, and that was plenty for me.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, of course, this was a test. This was to see just how far you could go. So, I mean, there's obviously going to be a bit of range anxiety built into that, because if you were stopped on the, ended up running out of juice on the dual carriageway out of Sligo, it wouldn't be very exciting. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
That's very true. But luckily enough, we had a little bit of extra confidence behind us because we do work for the AA. So it was just a case of ringing one of the guys and getting a little bit of assistance if we needed it.
For them to drive out in their diesel van and hook you up to a petrol generator. But anyway, listen, I'm not anti-EV, by the way. There just is an irony there. Terms of the cost, do we know how much it cost on power? Not that, but this is kind of a factor, I suppose, when people are considering, you know, electric as an option. Though we have this thing built into us that if we do anything green, it has to be cheaper for us. And I think those days are coming to an end in terms of a lot of things, including EV driving. So I think that what we save, we're supposed to really be motivated by what we save in terms of the planet rather than our pockets. But anyway, as it stands right now, how much do you think this journey would have cost in electric versus petrol or diesel, I wonder?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, the answer to your question is how long is a piece of string? Because, you know, when we're used to petrol and diesel rates, we have a national average, or we know we're going to go down the road and it's going to be somewhere between 160 and 165, give or take. But, you know, there's situations where people could be charging them for free because they've got solar panels on the roof. But if you're clever, you've got a night rate meter, we could have done that trip for in and around 15 euros. However, if you charged exclusively on the high power ESB chargers, you could be paying up towards 60, 70 euros, something like that. So there's a big variance. But, you know, for the ease of answering you, you could say something like 25, 30 euros, just having paid, you know, standard home electricity rate.
And then obviously with a petrol or diesel car, that would have been, you know, 60, 70, 80 euro, depending on how you drove. A full tank of diesel for most people now, you know, is close to 100 euro. So so that puts it into perspective. Obviously, a diesel car would have done it with ease. And you know, we appreciate that. But the emissions would have been very different.
Yeah. And I think, too, I mean, obviously, you're in a state of the art vehicle there. Even with your, I think, you know, the 2023, you know, average electric car, you probably would have done the same journey with one or two charges, certainly two charges you'd have hoped to, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's it's a good point. I actually did the same trip myself in a Tesla Model Y about 6 months ago, and I did the whole trip with a 15-minute stop just outside Galway. And that's a car now that you can get into for about 46,000 euros, which is not extreme, you know, not far off the average in the country.
Yeah, but the big problem is, and we've heard this from people in the industry as well, so it's not naysayers or, you know, what have you, is the charging infrastructure. The 1 million electric cars, they've thrown that target out the window. I think industry expects it. We'll be lucky if we get to 500,000 at this point. But even if we do, and even if a lot of those are full electric, we really need to sort out the infrastructure here, don't we? Especially even for the tourism market, because, you know, like a lot of people look at Google reviews now and what have you. Say you guys were a couple of tourists from Germany and you happen to arrive at beautiful Malinhead with the expectation that clearly they're going to have significant charging infrastructure here because it's so popular. And then you have to sort of beg, borrow and steal to get your plug-ins through someone's front door. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the infrastructure here is a real problem, I think, as you have highlighted yourselves.
You're right, Greg. And, you know, what really struck us as we, you know, we went back the next morning to Malinhead to take some photographs, and there's a toilet area, there's some handicap spots, there's but there's no charging points. And you think, right, this is an absolute opportunity. And as well as that, for some of the businesses as well, there are big grants for putting wall boxes in. And it seems like a missed opportunity for cafes and restaurants and the like not to put those in, because you have a captive audience for 40 minutes or so, and they'll have their lunch and they'll drink their coffee as they charge their car up. So look, yeah, more needs to be done for sure.
I wonder, has anyone done an analysis of what we would actually need? You know what I mean? Like, there's been numerous announcements over the last couple of years, because we would cover them on this, of ESB investment, of that investment. But really, in my route, I travel about 50 kilometres to work daily. I don't really, and I would keep an eye out for things like this, I don't see the addition of any additional charging points. On my route, there is one extra fast charger. There's a couple on the side of the street that you often see petrol diesel cars sitting in. You know, I'm just thinking, if lots of us had electric cars, how many would we actually need? I mean, has anyone done any evaluation of that? Because this is a little bit like the meetings that they have annually to talk about the climate. We seem to be talking an awful lot about it. We seem to know where we need to be, what the solutions are. But when you get down to it, how much is actually really happening? And for me, Blake, it feels not enough or very little.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we remember seeing some words coming from ESB a few months ago saying that they feel that it was adequate at the time. And we know for a fact it's not, because, you know, my own personal car is an EV. I've been driving it for 5 years now. And I see queues sometimes when I turn up. Now, frequently, you know, let's say for me personally, 3/4 of the time, they're free. You just plug straight in and you go. But there's that chance that you can plug in at 8 o'clock, or, you know, you go to charge at 8 o'clock in the morning on your way to work. It's two cars ahead of you. And now it's, oh, what am I supposed to do? So we need more. But also the crucial thing, Greg, is that we need them in the right places, the right chargers at the right places. So if you've got one charger in Carndonagh and one in Mallon and so on and so forth, it's just not enough to rely on. So what we're better off with is these hubs. So, you know, if you turn up, there's 8 or 10 chargers there. And even if they are all full, ask somebody to be gone in a couple of minutes. It's fine. So it's a balance of both, and we definitely need a lot more. We need investment in it, and that needs to be led by the government as well.
Yeah, for sure. And Paddy, particularly given the fact that this is an area that there are an awful lot of detractors, and I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but you know yourself, people will talk about, well, how do we mine the sources for electric batteries? What do we do once they're finished? And what about the expense? And, you know, there's an awful lot of counter arguments to this. If you want people to go, actually, that's a viable option for me, and to sort of strengthen your argument in favour of them, you do need to get simple things like infrastructure correct, or else you're fighting a losing battle.
Correct. And what we've noticed from the surveys we would do to our customers, members, is that the primary reason people go for an EV is the potential cost savings. You know, we'd love to think that it's for environmental reasons, but it's simply not. So if people do start seeing the costs, and we are seeing the change in that, and look, electricity is increasing a lot, but there is quite a difference to be made now, not on the initial purchase price, but on the running costs. So I think once people start to see that, and as we look into the potential of diesel costs increasing in the next while as well, we might see people moving over for various reasons, cost being the primary one, but environmental being a happy byproduct of that.
Yeah, but we also have to accept that if the government makes an awful lot of money in terms of tax and what have you from petrol and diesel vehicles, and if there's less tax to take from that, they are going to have to sort of keep that. They are going to have to keep that that revenue stream coming. Right, okay. A lot of people wonder, but when do you guys think electric cars will become affordable to the average person? But I'm seeing electric cars advertised now. You know, they're not the main models necessarily, in and around, you know, 28, 29, 30 grand, which is the equivalent to sort of a budget crossover type vehicle. I mean, are we at the point yet whereby people can make a choice if they're taking out a loan or whatever the way they're doing it, and there are EV options for their, you know, petrol or diesel first choice maybe?
Oh yeah, the prices we're not at parity yet, but it's getting a lot closer. So I think you touched on it there already. You can get into the MG4 now for €29,000, and that's a solid 300-kilometre car with space inside similar to a Golf, not a 100 time of 7.5 seconds, plenty of power. Great tech inside. The car will steer and power itself on the motorway with adaptive cruise control. And then only there a few days ago, Tesla announced massive price decreases. So you can get into a Model 3 now for about 44,000 euros. So the prices are coming down. We're not at parity yet. And then the other thing that you look at is if you want to go in and order something like the 94 or some of the Audis, there's waiting lists that are approaching a year's time. So if you consider, why would a manufacturer lower the price down if they've got waiting lists for a product for up to a year? And we could see the bad. Like, here's another.
With that being said, though, and I'm not being, I'm not sort of being argumentative, but Tesla's just dropped a significant lump off their cars into the Irish market. You know, so I suppose maybe the global. You know, there's a global element to this rather than just. But I take your point. And finally, how much is that car sitting? How much is that car worth? I mean, obviously, you've well, pulled a few strings at Mercedes here, I think.
The car that we are sitting in with options, mind you, is 168,000 euros. So not affordable by any means.
But it's a nice three bed. That's a nice three bedroom bungalow for you in Donegal, by the way. Now. Not great for the commute
rather,
to work.
I think I would rather that. But I suppose what happens with these things is the technology does trickle down. So whilst this is you know, not affordable for the majority of people, the technology does start to trickle down. And over the years, you'll see it coming into more affordable cars.
Right, gentlemen. So really, you're the first until such time as someone else tells you they were the first to drive on a single charge in an EV from Mizzenhead to Malinhead. Is that really the safe space we'll leave that in? Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, if people want to look at our YouTube channel, there is evidence of such. So so unless someone comes back with the contrary evidence, then we can claim that we've done it.
All right, listen, thanks very much indeed. Safe journey home. We appreciate it. Thanks for your time. That's Blake Boland, Paddy Cummins, Head of Communications with the AA. Some of you listening aren't massive fans of the electric car situation. Actually, do you know what would be interesting? Because there's an awful lot out there as it relates about mining, the batteries, what do you do with the batteries into the future? What's the implications in terms of the production of electric cars on the environment versus and how the materials are sourced? We might actually get an expert on to discuss that. Because I'll read these comments out. I'm not 100% sure if they're true or not. I know there are sort of people who are maybe anti this agenda that push this stuff, or maybe they are do care about kids mining materials in some other countries. I really don't know. But I think it would be a worthwhile interview, wouldn't it? And we'd get the facts one way or other.